I'd like to spend Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at this hour on the Sermon on the Mount. That arises out of a number of things. Paul Hayne had a session on government, a couple of sessions on government last week. What considerations come into play when I, as a Christian, try to work out my relationships to government alongside of or in support of or against, or how do I figure out my basic stance toward government? Saturday night there was a Bible study, some of you came to that, led by Paul Hayne on Galatians, and the whole question of the law arose, and we had been talking about the Spirit. And how does one relate law and spirit if I want to know how to behave, if I want to know what I'm supposed to do, if I want to know how to go about making decisions in a in the context of a particular problem? How do I go about doing that? Of what help is the law? If the law is of some help, which law? Is there some connection or some disjunction between the law of God and the law of the land? Or am I, as a Christian, free from the law, so that the law has nothing to say, but I'm only led by the Spirit, and the Spirit tells me what to do in each new situation, and I don't have anything to do with the law? How do I relate Spirit and law? These kinds of questions have been arising. It seemed to me that it might make some sense to take a look at the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount is one of the basic passages in the Bible to which people go to get some kind of a response to the question, what ought I to do? And so very commonly, there is a kind of parallel between the law in the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments, and the law in the New Testament, the Sermon on the Mount. And so people talk about the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount as kind of the basic ethical passages in the Bible. Besides that, the Sermon on the Mount is, by all odds, the most well-known, most read, most popular passage in the New Testament. It always has been. You can read through the Church Fathers. No, you can't read through the Church Fathers. There's too much stuff there. But you can get some signals from a lot of people who have worked with the Church Fathers and find out that they refer to the Sermon on the Mount more than to any other three-chapter section in the New Testament. Or you can go to the Interpreter's Bible, which is, I think, 12-volume commentary on the New Testament. You go to the index, there are more references to the Sermon on the Mount than to any other section in the New Testament. Or you can listen to sermons for a while, and you can very soon discover, or if you look back over your sermon listening times, you can know that you've heard more sermons probably on Sermon on the Mount texts than on any other three-chapter section of the New Testament. It's an overwhelmingly well-read and much-discussed passage, not only among Christians. Gandhi made up his religion from the Sermon on the Mount and the Bhagavad Gita. He didn't like Christians, but he liked Jesus. He didn't like the church, but he liked the Sermon on the Mount. And so Gandhi took the Sermon on the Mount and the Bhagavad Gita, and he put them together, and he got out nonviolent resistance against the British Empire, and he won. there are Jewish people who, of course, don't believe about Jesus what we believe about Jesus, but they think Jesus was super great, and who think that the Sermon on the Mount was super great. This is a quotation from Joseph Klausner, who is a Jewish scholar. He says, Jesus is, for the Jewish people, a great teacher of morality and an artist in parable. In his ethical code, there is a sublimity, distinctiveness, and originality in form unparalleled in any other Hebrew ethical code. If ever the day should come when the Sermon on the Mount could be stripped of its wrappings of miracle and mystery, the book of the ethics of Jesus, that is the Sermon on the Mount, would be one of the choicest treasures in the literature of Israel for all time. So from Gandhi to many Jewish people, to the Kiwanis and Rotary Clubs, to the Boy Scouts of America, everybody says the Sermon on the Mount is really a super great way of knowing what we ought to do, how we ought to behave. Okay, so it makes it, it seems to me, a worthwhile text for us to look at. And I've put the title on there, Does It Help to Turn the Other Cheek? That's a passage, as you know, from the Sermon on the Mount. And the question is, okay, maybe we ought to do that, but does it help? That is, what if everybody turns the other cheek? Would that be a good thing? Can you institutionalize turning the other cheek? Can you make that a rule for groups of people, for nations, as well as for individuals? Can you make it a rule for individuals in every situation or just in some situations? Does it help to turn the other cheek? What I'd like to do today is to lay out some issues and also lay out some ways in which the Sermon on the Mount can be read and to have some time for conversation. And we'll move tomorrow into chapter 5, where Jesus says, you've heard it said, but I say to you, and work on that relationship to the Old Testament law. And on Wednesday, we'll go into chapter 6 and 7. Some of you were in the eye-opener this morning. What you know affects what you see. I think the converse or obverse or whatever that is also true. What you see affects what you know, but it's for sure that what you know affects what you see. The text is always contextualized. The word is always enfleshed. I hammered hard last night in Vespers on naming the name, but that name is never naked. That name is embedded in tradition and talk and information and data. And what you know affects, of course, what you see and what you hear. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to feed you some information, some of which you already have, some of which you may not have, because what you know is going to affect what you see. And so let's begin with some very obvious items that are just sticking out in the text itself, which you may or may not have noticed. One item is that a good portion of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, occurs in Luke 6. It begins with the Beatitudes, contains much of the same material, but about half of the material. Not in exactly the same order, but in kind of the same order. The sixth chapter of Luke. In Matthew 5, it says Jesus went up on the mountain. And in Luke 6, it says Jesus was standing there in an open place. So Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is generally called the Sermon on the Mount. And Luke 6 is generally called the Sermon on the Plain. But it's the same stuff. That is, the Sermon on the Plain is about half of the same stuff as the Sermon on the Mount. Well, now, we've got to deal with that. And you can say, if you want, that there were two sermons. That is, that one time Jesus stood on the mountain, and if you go to Israel, the guide will show you that mountain and the little place where Jesus stood when he delivered the Sermon on the Mount. And then on another occasion, he stood on the plain and gave the Sermon on the Plain. But you can also begin to wonder whether it was not the case that the evangelist in each case, Matthew and Luke, took remembered materials from the sayings of Jesus and put them together in some kind of shape and form for the purpose of telling about Jesus in a particular way. And that is kind of reinforced by the structure of Matthew's Gospel, where in 7:28, the end of the Sermon on the Mount, the last verse says, "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings," and if you read through Matthew's Gospel, there are four repetitions of that phrase. "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings," I'll give you the verses, we won't look at them now, if you want to look at them later, it's 7:28, 11:1, 13:53, 19:1, 26:1, and Matthew's whole gospel is arranged in terms of a section which tells about what Jesus did, and then there's a long discourse. Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is the first of those. "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings, he went on to do something else." And then there's a section of doing things, and then he says another long discourse, and it says, "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings," then he does something else, then there's a long discourse. "Now when Jesus has finished these sayings." So Matthew takes the data of the church's remembrance about Jesus and packs it into five chunks. A in each case is some activity. B in each case is a long discourse. Well, now, Mark isn't like that. Luke isn't like that. John isn't like that. That's Matthew's way of contextualizing the text. That's Matthew's way of enfleshing or re-enfleshing the word. That's Matthew's way of telling about Jesus. So somehow or another, it seems to me, one has to face the involvement of the evangelist in the material. Matthew had something to do with putting these words in this particular shape and order and sequence. That doesn't mean Jesus didn't say these things, but they are filtered through the church's witness, in this case, specifically through the evangelist Matthew. Now, that means that it gets a little bit complicated, and we have to face the fact that we're dealing here not with simple, pure words of Jesus, any more than we're dealing with bread that dropped out of heaven that has to go through the kitchen first. So the words of Jesus have to go through the church first, and do go through the church first, and we get them contextualized by the evangelist. So that's a complication. Another complication when you look simply at the text itself is that at the beginning it says, "Jesus, seeing the crowds, went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying." So you get the idea in the first verse of chapter 5 that Jesus is teaching his disciples. That's a discipleship ethic. Jesus isn't telling everybody to do this. He's telling his disciples to do this. But 7:28 at the end says, "And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished." What do you do with that? Do you think that what happened was that Jesus was all his people, and he wanted to say something specifically to his disciples, so he said, hey, everybody look over there. And when the crowds were looking over there, he said, come on, gang. Ran up on the mountain. So he started teaching his disciples. But then finally they found him. And towards the end of the Sermon on the Mount, all of these people started coming up. And he wound up talking to everybody. And the crowds were astonished. So maybe then one has to worry a little bit about maybe the first part of the Sermon on the Mount was for the disciples, but the last part was for everybody. Or are we kind of stuck with the question? Is this material for disciples only, or is this material for everybody? Are these rules by which Christians live with one another in personal relationships, or are these words rules by which governments ought to run society? And obviously, people have read the Sermon on the Mount in each one of those ways. Well, those are some issues that arise simply from the text, simply from looking at the text with some care. If we go, secondly, into the history of the reading of the text, if we take seriously the fact that the Bible is the church's book, if we take seriously the fact that we are not alone as Christians, but we are together with other believers, if we take seriously the fact that the Holy Spirit did not begin with us, but has been at work in the church lo these many centuries, if we take seriously the fact that we do not contain all the truth in our own little heads or selves, but that we need one another in order to understand the dimensions of the text, then we ought to pay some attention to the way in which the Sermon on the Mount has been read by other Christians. At least we ought to have that information. And what we know might affect what we see in the text. I'm rather inclined to think that it does. Okay, so let's go through some ways in which the Sermon on the Mount has been read. I'm going to do that, and we'll have some time for conversation. Maybe we'll talk about like 10 of them or something. One way in which the Sermon on the Mount can be read is what I would call an absolutist reading. Absolute means not relative. Absolute means timeless, not relative to any particular time, not relative to any particular place, not relative to any particular situation, but for every time and every person and every situation, absolute. There are a lot of people who have read the Sermon on the Mount in this way, some more consistently than others. One who read it in an absolutist sense, more absolutely, I think, than most, was Leo Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy read the Sermon on the Mount saying, this is what Jesus said, and Jesus meant what he said, and what he said was clear, and I'm a follower of Jesus, and so whether I like it or not makes no difference at all. I am to do in every situation, and everybody else is to do in every situation, what Jesus said. So Tolstoy took, for instance, Matthew 5:39, which says, resist no evil. Tolstoy said, that's very clear, don't resist evil. That means no police force. That means no army. That means no coercion of any kind. Don't resist evil, period. Chapter 7, verse 1, judge not. Tolstoy said, that's absolutely clear. Don't judge. So let's do away with the law courts. Let's do away with the judges. Let's do away with the lawyers. That's obviously clear. Tolstoy tried to function that way in society for a while. He had some difficulty doing that. He was a very wealthy man. He retreated to his estate And he tried to set up the rule of the Sermon on the Mount for himself and his family and his servant people. And he had great difficulty doing that, and he finally left his estate then and tried to live that out as a lone individual, and died a short time after he left the estate. Tolstoy represents in a classic way that absolutist position. Here's a quote from him. He says, "We may declare the universal practice of the rule of not resisting evil as being very difficult. We may deny that he who follows it will find happiness. We may say with the unbelievers that it's stupid, that Christ was a dreamer, an idealist who pronounced impracticable maxims which his disciples followed out of sheer stupidity. But it is impossible not to admit that Christ expressed in a manner at once clear and precise what he wished to say, namely that according to his doctrine, a person must not resist evil." Okay, that's one way of reading the Sermon on the Mount. I call that an absolutist way. We're going to look at some others, every one of which is some qualification of that. Every one of which in some way or another says, gee, you've got to pay attention to the situation. There are new contexts, there are new times and new places that have to be taken into consideration. So let's look at some of those. One way that the Sermon on the Mount has been read is to say, yes, Jesus said what he meant, and he meant what he said, and it's clear, but there are some exceptions. Okay, Luther on 542, which says, give to him who begs from you. Luther says, give to him who begs of you, but not what he asks for. Now, we got that Saturday night from someone when the question was asked, what if a drunk comes up to you and asks you for 50 cents? And someone said, what you do is take him out and buy him a meal. Okay? That was in accordance with what Luther would say. You give to him, but not what he asks for. Someone else said, what do you do for a drunk who asks you for 50 cents? Another person said, you give him a dollar. See? Which is what the Lord said, which is a spin-off from where Jesus says if someone asks you to go 1 mile, you go two. You don't take them out for a meal, you give them a buck. Okay, so we had Saturday night even, we had some historical positions represented around this fire. The Didache, which is an early Christian document, talks about the words of the Sermon on the Mount, and on that same verse says, give to him who asks of you, but let it sweat in your palm for a moment first. That is, think about it. Think about it a moment, because this may be an exceptional case. All right? Matthew 5:22 says, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Does anyone happen to have a King James Version? Yeah. What does it say? 5:22.
But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause.
All right. Did you notice the difference? RSV says, whoever is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. King James says, whoever is angry with his brother, comma, without cause, comma, is liable to be to judgment. If you look in your RSV, there's a little footnote there, and it says, other ancient authorities read, without cause. What happened? There's no question here, but that the original text, at least as far as we can get back to the original text, said flat out, whoever is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Some scribe is copying that, making a new manuscript. Whoever is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. He says, come on, Jesus. See? And so he writes in the margin, comma, without cause, comma. I mean, there's such a thing as righteous indignation. We all know that. The next guy comes along and copies that manuscript, and he sees that gloss on the margin, and he has to make a decision about that. And he says to himself, what is this? Did the previous scribe write that in out of his own head, or did he miss that when he was copying and then saw it later and then write it into the margin? And so he flips a coin and puts it into the text. And the next guy, of course, copies it, and the thing gets firmly embedded in the text. And the King James Version, which is based essentially on a 13th century manuscript, is based on a manuscript that by that time has that exception clause already built into the text. What that means is that the exception thing is not just something that Luther comes up with, or the Didache, or you and I. The earliest church struggled with these words of Jesus and said, there have to be some exceptions here. Another case in point is Matthew 5:32, which says, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, comma, except on the ground of unchastity, comma, makes her an adulteress. Anybody happen to remember that passage in Luke or Mark? Mark is probably the earliest gospel we have, and it's a flat-out statement. Anyone who divorces his wife commits adultery, period. But by the time Matthew comes along, an exception has already been built into the church's understanding of those words of Jesus, and so we've got comma, except on the grounds of unchastity. So there is, from the earliest days in the church, running parallel perhaps with an absolutist reading of the Sermon on the Mount, a reading which says, okay, but there are exceptions. So that's one non-absolutist way. What about another non-absolutist way, which maybe we could call exaggeration or hyperbole? That is to say that Jesus was a communicator. He really wanted to get his point across, and he used all kinds of devices to do that. How about in the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7, verse 4, Jesus says, how are you going to get that speck out of your brother's eye when you've got a telephone pole in your own? I mean, that's very funny, see? But we don't catch the humor of a lot of things that Jesus says because we think we ought not to laugh when we read the Bible, maybe. But it's very funny. And Jesus said a lot of very funny things. Huh? Now, you obviously can't have a telephone pole in your eye, but that's a nice way of saying it. How are you going to get the speck out of your brother's eye when you got a telephone pole on your own? So then you might say, Jesus did a lot of that kind of thing. If your right eye offends you, pluck it out. Well, I don't know if there's a one-eyed Christian in the room here, you know, who's followed that word of Jesus, because we say, oh yeah, I get it. I get it, Jesus. Huh? He is, he's doing the telephone pole thing again. Huh? Or if someone wants you to go 1 mile, go 2. Okay, Jesus, ho, 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 I get it. Good point, see? Well, there's something to that. Huh? And if one reads the words of Jesus so piously that one never catches the humor, one never catches the exaggerations, then certainly the thing has been misconstrued, has been missed. On the other hand, if we take everything and say that's an exaggeration, then we miss it too. Huh? So how do you work with that? How do you recognize the hyperbole and still take it seriously? Another way of reading the Sermon on the Mount non-absolutistically is to say that what Jesus is talking about is not specific rules, but general principles. So that he says, if you're struck on the right cheek, turn the other also. What does that mean? If you're hit on the left cheek, you belt them one. Huh? No. Can't mean that. That's a general principle. I think probably most of you have heard about the famous Southeast Minnesota District of the ALC convention a few years ago in Minneapolis. This was, I think, in the early 70s or late 60s when the Vietnam War was being protested, and a group of people showed up to protest the Vietnam War. And during the communion service, they took all their clothes off and walked up to the communion rail. The link there in the argument is a little difficult for me to get, but that was a protest against the Vietnam War. And as it turned out, the people who were the celebrants there simply gave the bread and wine to those people, and there was no big to-do about it. And they were upset about that. And as they walked out, one guy in the front row expressed his opinion about that particular act of protest. And they were upset about that. And as they walked out, one guy in the front row expressed his opinion about that particular act of protest by whacking one of the girls on the rear end, and later said, well, we know that they weren't Christians because she didn't turn the other cheek. I mean, there are new contexts, you know, for these things. Jesus says, chapter 6, verse 2, when you give alms, don't sound your trumpet before you. Well, that doesn't cover me because I play the trombone. I'm clear. So, I mean, obviously, there's something to that, again, that Jesus is not just giving specific rules, but what he's doing is laying out some general principles. On the other hand, if we flatten all of this stuff out into general principles, we don't any longer have it, do we? So there's some dangers there. Let's look at another non-absolutist way, and that is to say that what Jesus is talking about is not the act itself, but he's talking about the intention. St. Augustine said this. Says, Jesus says, if someone asks you to go 1 mile, go two. He doesn't mean that you have to go two. What he means is that you have to be willing to go two. Obviously, there might be some times when you can't do that, but you have to be willing to do it. And that thing from Augustine gets put into extremely sophisticated form by Immanuel Kant, who is one of the great landmarks in the development of Christian ethics, who says there is nothing in this world or outside of this world that can be called good without qualification other than a good will. And Kant is the major figure in the development of Protestant ethics, whereas Aristotle is the major figure in the development of Roman Catholic ethics. And Kant says, what's important is the motive, the will, the intention, and most Protestants tend to think that to be the case. We like it in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus says you can't hang good fruit on a bad tree. What's necessary is that the tree become good, and then the fruit will naturally come. Luther is on that same Augustinian Kantian line. And Luther says, good works don't make a good man, but a good man does good works. That is, what's necessary is for the heart to become renewed, and then the good stuff will just flow out. And what you do in a particular case is not so important. What's important is that your heart be right, the intention. Now, that's obviously not the only way to look at it. There are other people on the Aristotelian, Thomistic line, Roman Catholic line, who would say what's important is the end result. I don't give a rip what your heart is like. I couldn't care less what your will or your intention is like. I want to know, what in the world are you doing, and what is the effect of your action? It's the end, the Jesuits have said, that justifies the means, okay? It's the end. So it's not just the intention, but it's the effect. So that's a whole big stream in the development of Christian ethics, and that also is true with relation to the Sermon on the Mount. So that the classic Roman Catholic tradition has distinguished between what they call precepts for salvation and evangelical counsels. And the precepts for salvation are the Ten Commandments. You have to do the Ten Commandments in order to get saved. But if you want to be a really good Christian, then you do the things in the Sermon on the Mount. And the basic passage for that is a passage of the rich young ruler, Matthew 19, where you remember the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, what should I do to be saved? Jesus says, you know the law. And he says, gee, I've done that stuff since I've been a little kid. Jesus says, okay, now, if you would be perfect, sell what you have and give to the poor. And so there is a double standard functioning there. The Ten Commandments are necessary for salvation. The Sermon on the Mount is not for your everyday, ordinary man on the street corner slob Christian. It has nothing to do with that person. The Sermon on the Mount has to do with those Christians who want to be perfect. And you take the vows of chastity and poverty and obedience, and then you begin to take the Sermon on the Mount for yourself, but not for the everyday, ordinary Christian. Okay, Luther comes along, and Luther says, there's something wrong with the view that the Sermon on the Mount is an absolute rule for everybody. Tolstoy, absolutist. Throw out the law courts, throw out the armies. There's something wrong with that. The Sermon on the Mount isn't for everybody. There's also something wrong with the notion that the Sermon on the Mount is only for super Christians. The Sermon on the Mount is for all Christians. So Luther develops a view which he calls the two realms, or the two kingdoms. And he says, God rules the whole world, but he rules it in a double fashion. He rules it with his left hand, that is, in a kind of a hidden way, with the sword. And he rules it with his right hand through grace and love and forgiveness. And the Christian lives in both realms. It isn't that the one belongs to the devil and the other belongs to God. They both belong to God, but he functions differently in the world and in the church. So the Sermon on the Mount, Luther says, has nothing whatsoever to do with the kingdom on the left. If you try to run a government on the basis of the Sermon on the Mount, the whole place will collapse yesterday. Can't do that. It's not intended for that. The Sermon on the Mount is intended to be a function of the kingdom on the right and is a way in which Christians relate to one another personally. So Luther's always talking about the hangman. And Luther says, let's say the hangman is a Christian. Well, he goes to work in the morning, shaves, and takes a shower, and goes and picks up his axe, and the head is on the block, and and he tries to do as good a job as he can, that's a kingdom on the left. That's the way God functions in the kingdom on the left. But when he goes home, he ought really not to do that, you know, to his wife and children, because here he's functioning in the kingdom on the right. And there it's a matter of turning the other cheek, going the other mile, and all that kind of stuff. Now, Luther does talk about the hangman, he does talk about the soldier, he does talk about the judge, and he does talk about the Christian who is at the same time in both kingdoms, and he tries to sweat that out. It seems to me there are lots of problems when one tries to apply that. Lots of problems. But negatively, it serves very well as a huge umbrella to say, on the one hand, the Sermon on the Mount is not for everybody, it's for Christians. On the other hand, it isn't only for super Christians, it's for all Christians. A couple of quickies, and we'll quit. There are lots of these. Let me just mention. There are people who read the Sermon on the Mount in terms of repentance, who say that the Sermon on the Mount is God's law for perfection. None of us can follow it. God knows that. Jesus knows that. But it's a mirror. And so we look at what we ought to be, we see that our face is dirty, and we repent and receive forgiveness. Huh? There's no way that you can live like that, but you can be driven to repentance and into the arms of Jesus and receive forgiveness. There are people who say that's the function of the Sermon on the Mount. Schweitzer said that the Sermon on the Mount was an interim ethic designed for a few weeks prior to the coming of the kingdom. The kingdom didn't come. And so the Sermon on the Mount is totally irrelevant for us, and Schweitzer builds a whole new ethic on the basis of reverence for life, which is a kind of a mixture of Hinduism and Christianity. There is a way in which some people read the Sermon on the Mount in terms of paradigm or illustration. Joseph Sittler says that the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Sermon on the Mount, are like a gull swoop down to the water, picks up a piece of bread, and on. It just makes contact like that. Or it's like you're on a ship at night, and it's a storm, and it's raining, and it's pitch black, and all of a sudden there's a bolt of lightning, and you see everything clearly for a second, and then it's dark again. It's like someone would come and say, what do Christians do? How do Christians behave? And you scratch your head and say, gee, that's a toughie. What should I say? Hey, there is one. There goes one. Let's see what the Christian does. And you take out your Super 8, and someone says, mind giving me your coat? Oh, sure. Coat, overcoat. Guy says, would you mind carrying this for me a mile? The guy's 2 miles, huh? And so you see what in fact Christians do. You clip out one little frame of that film, and you just kind of catch it in the air. You say, here, how do you like that? Here's another one. Huh? They aren't rules. Huh? They are pictures of Christians in action. They're illustrations of the shape and the style of the redeemed life. I obviously find that attractive. It doesn't cover all the bases by any means. I think that all of these may have some kind of legitimacy, and all of them have some kind of problems, but I think we have to say more than that. I think we have to use the history of the interpretation of a text to help locate ourselves. And I've got to make some kind of decision about how I'm going to read that text, at least for the time being, and what I know affects what I see. The options that have been present in the church are going to affect how, in fact, I come out reading a particular text. Well, that's just some kind of stuff for today. What do you have any reactions, comments, questions? Yeah.
What thing I was really caught by earlier when you were talking about how the church has filtered through it and put in exceptions, you know, the part about anger without cause,
yeah,
divorce except in the case of adultery. And I was thinking, it seems like terribly much like man's attempt to read this stuff and be able to measure himself up as self-justified. In other words, if you could read, you know, the Sermon on the Mount, and there's just some things, you know, like, well, you know, if you have a good cause, you know, then you're okay, you know. Instead of taking God's absolute and saying, you know, that we shouldn't be angry with each other, instead, you know, it's the person who's sitting there who measures up everywhere else, but, boy, this, you know, this is his problem, you know. So he's trying to sit there before God and say, you know, I make it, God, you know, I make it on all these lines, instead of just recognizing that he has something yet left to work on. You know, to put everything he has into.
It can be that. I guess that I would want to say it's not necessarily simply that, because not only the without cause stuff, but every word in there is filtered through the church's witness, so that the grammar of Jesus' words in the Gospel of John, for instance, is different from the grammar of Jesus' words in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He talks a different way. There is no way that we can get back to the naked Jesus, the absolute word. The word is always enfleshed. The word always comes to us through the witness of the church, and we're stuck with that, and it's God's decision to stick us with that. And that has a lot to do with what Christianity is about. So that we've got to decide in a given case whether this is a cop-out or whether it is a legitimate window into what Jesus is really about. And it often is a cop out. But that's a decision we have to make.
That one,
yeah, right.
The exceptions.
So yeah.
Continually try to put exceptions on things.
Uh huh. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Where are you?
I'm here.
Yes.
I'm disturbed about what Luther said, because if someone can say they have a public job and can do whatever they want in their best interest, and it seems that they're lacking in responsibility. If someone can, be in the military, that's the easy example. And maybe just anything, killing people or whatever, and say, well, that's part of my job, my public job, but I'm nice to my family. I don't think that's a Christian life, a total Christian life, that you're a different person because you're a Christian. You can be anyone then and be a good family person. Or, you know, in a corporation, and what they're using, some corporation in South America is now using prisoners because they didn't want to pay the wage of the people of the land. If you can say, well, then Americans are going to have to pay more for their coffee, something like that, so I'll make this decision. It just seems that the people themselves are just devoid of responsibility.
Yeah. It's very good, you know, that you say that. And in the minute or so that I tried to state Luther's position, I certainly did state that very crassly. And Luther is by no means, of course, that crass. He anguishes like crazy about those things. And he does, over and over again, come up with extremely critical things to say about the electors and all of those government people. It is the case, however, that he comes out fairly conservatively toward government. And I think that what is at stake is whether one thinks that, let's say, sin has screwed up the social order to an extent, and screwed up our own mentality to an extent, that prior to the return of Christ and the resurrection and heaven and all that, we're going to have to live with some kind of checks, coercive checks on evil. And Luther said, yes, we do. Luther was not for withdrawing from society and making our own little love nest somewhere. And he was not for Christians simply suffering martyrdom. He was for Christians working within the established order. And he was saying that there simply have to be some checks against evil, and that force and such is a necessity, and that's part of God's ruling of his creation in this time. And so he does, he's not a pacifist, and he does anguish with how a Christian can serve those roles in society. So if it becomes a cop-out again, then, you know, that would be totally wrong, but that's not what Luther intended. Now, one can disagree with Luther and say, as Tolstoy said, resist evil means don't resist evil, period. And of course, the traditional peace churches have latched on to the Sermon on the Mount, as Roman Catholics have latched on to Matthew 16, and Lutherans have latched on to Romans 1, and millennialists have latched on to Revelation 20. The Sermon on the Mount is the great passage for the peace churches, of course.
There's a couple questions on the text. The New English here has not he was angry, but just whether he knew nurse's anger. Is that also something put in between commas? And the second thing is, in the passage about resisting evil, it doesn't say here, do not resist evil. It says, do not set yourself against the man who wrongs you. And it seems to me that to say do not resist evil is sort of making a statement about some kind of principle. You know, don't resist evil as some kind of a principle. But it seems to me different to say, don't set yourself against the man who wrongs you. What about that in the text?
Yeah. There is no such thing, of course, as a literal translation. Every translation is an interpretation. And in the second case, the noun evil there is, I'm almost positive, masculine. And so it can refer to the evil one. It could refer to the devil. It could refer to that male individual or that generic human being who is evil. Or it could refer to evil. And so no matter how you translate that, you're involved in interpretation. And so then you have to talk about that. On the nursing evil thing, I haven't looked at that recently, and I don't recall. It could be that is a present imperative, and the present tense in Greek does carry that continuous action connotation. So if it is present tense, then it would make some sense to say nurses evil, that is, to continue in that attitude, and that would be a very good translation. I'd have to look that up. I don't know that. Yeah.
The thing, if I'm interesting in the absolutist position, says, okay, it says this is what must be done, so that must be done. And says, okay, and he says, okay, I've done this since my youth. He says, in order to be saved, I must do this. I believe that I am saved, therefore I believe I must be doing this. Because, or somebody must be doing this, and therefore all of us who are saved, we are the ones who complain right all the time. And therefore we are right. Well, somebody looks on this and says, well, I can't quite swallow that one. So we'll come up with the hedges. And we'll say, this must be done, with certain exceptions. And I am saved, therefore I must have done it. So everything that I did wrong must belong in the exceptions. And so we sweep everything I can handle into the things that I have done, so I am saved, and everything we can handle, we sweep into the obvious exception. And all of this seems to be just ridiculous to me. It seems to leave out altogether the fact that my sins are covered, and that I do sin, and that each day, in seeking to follow the will of God, I blow it. and I step across the line, and I do the things that are forbidden. And for this, I am forgiven, and I get a new play, and I get to play again. And I am told which way to go, in words which are not absolutely clear, but in which the intent is clear. And I do the best that I can in the light of the Spirit as I feel it. And I do some things right, and I do some things wrong, and I again seek forgiveness. But to be absolutist about it and say that in order that I be saved, I must do it right.
Yeah, we've got. The thing about this is I've done since my youth is not an absolutist position, but is that classic Roman Catholic. That's certainly not true today. But a classic Roman Catholic position, which views the Sermon on the Mount only as evangelical counsels for those who want to be perfect. It's the Ten Commandments that they think. This guy's referring to when he says, I've obeyed them since my youth. Of course, that passage of the rich young ruler, which in Matthew says, if you would be perfect, do so and so, is different in Luke, where it doesn't have that phrase, if you would be perfect. So even, you know, you have to back up on that proof text for that precepts counsels thing and ask which evangelist are you going to take.
That's a better joke than the telephone pole in the eye.
I think we'll leave it here for today and let those things bounce around in your head a little bit. Matthew 5, 6, and 7 are sufficiently short, so you could read that over a number of times these days. Tomorrow we're going to look at Jesus talk about the law. You've heard it said of old time, but I say to you, particularly at that passage where Jesus says, I came not to destroy but to fulfill. What does that mean? And then he goes on to say, you've heard it said of old time, but I say to you. So, thanks.